All right. Welcome to the RSP cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. And today I have a returning guest, which is one Rich Bartell. Rich Bartell is a quarterback development coach, former pro quarterback himself. And we had a wonderful conversation a few months ago with Will Hewlett talking about quarterback development. I just thought it'd be a great opportunity to bring him back on to talk a little bit more about the position. So Rich, thanks for coming back on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Matt. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, one of the things that I thought was, you know, knowing from your experience, you know, playing with the Cardinals, having stints with the Cowboys, playing in professional leagues, I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the hierarchy, if there is one, in a college or NFL quarterback room, or talk to me about what makes a good quarterback room from your experience.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and I think it's something I think that's overlooked a lot. You know, in high school, your quarterback room is kind of it's made up of who it's made up of, right? You don't have many choices there, you know. But as you move in to college football, you know, the hierarchy changes because people are recruited, and the expectations of each player is now the same, at least their own intrinsic motivations. And then, you know, obviously in the pro game, it's, you know, all that's just amplified. And so, you know, the answer to your question is yes, there's definitely a hierarchy in both locker rooms, whether it be college or the NFL. But, you know, social hierarchies aren't anything new, right? They're just, you know, the microcosm that happens in a college football team or an NFL team is the same thing that happens in society, right? So as long as our humans are involved, you know, it doesn't matter if it's government, business, family, schools, or teams, you're going to find hierarchy. And so, you know, the way I like to think of it is, like, there's these kind of implied expectations of quarterbacks when you're within an organization, right? And so those all happen within the context of team or unit, right? And so, you know, there's things that are expected of the starter within the context of a quarterback room, and things that are expected of the backup, and the things that are expected of maybe the third string. Nothing that's defined, but you all kind of fall in line, if you will, right? And then there's kind of, it's all that's explicitly shown, right? Through a depth chart, or, you know, in the NFL's case, through contract, you know. And so you typically know, but those things can be slightly out of order, you know, in the NFL, when a guy who makes less money, i.e. Dak Prescott, ends up becoming the starter due to injury to Tony Romo. And so those hierarchies, and socially, they can change, you know, week to week or season to season. And so it's a really dynamic thing that happens in the quarterback locker room. And so, you know, if you think about hierarchies, typically it's this top-down approach, you know. But what's tricky about in sport, particularly in the quarterback room, is you're not really looking for a top-down approach. You don't want that in a room, because at any given moment, the backup can become the starter, or in any given year, right? An Alex Smith can get traded out, and now Pat Mahomes, who was the backup the year prior, is now the franchise and face of a franchise. And so you don't want to castrate people, you know, in this top-down approach. You want to empower them. And so how do you do that? Well, you want to maintain harmony, right? But you're really looking for this more rotational principle of hierarchy, in my opinion. And so I think of, like, soccer teams. That's what I think of, not basketball teams. So, like, if you think of a top-down approach in basketball, I would think of, like, the Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan. You think of this main dominant figure, you know, and then you start to look for a true number two, a Scottie Pippen, who will never be the number one. And then you got your defender, rebounder, Dennis Rodman, your three-point shooter, your Steve Kerr. Well, you don't want that in a quarterback room. You know, I can't have a quarterback guy who's just – he's a dynamic leader and he's great on the run, but my number two is really my drop-back guy, and he's more subservient, more of a servant-type leadership. And then my third guy is really transformational. I need all my guys to be equally as dynamic for a lot of different reasons. And so why I think of soccer teams is because I think it's less of a defined hierarchy in soccer, and it kind of creates this really paradoxical approach to competition through another C word, which is cooperation. And that's really what you're looking for in a quarterback room. Why? Because every quarterback wants to lead. Every quarterback wants to play. Every quarterback needs influence. Every quarterback needs authority. They want to develop. But it's the cooperation to win and compete with each other on a day-in, day-out basis that I think is the biggest key to a QB room. So in my opinion, it's harmony, cooperation, and competition and they're not mutually exclusive of one another. And when any one of those things gets jacked up, when I get a guy that doesn't understand cooperation and he's only about competition, then we lack harmony in the room, and that's not good, right? And conversely, the opposite is true. So how do you create that? To me, I think you create it in a quarterback room by, you know, assigning essentially these task-related things to the hierarchy. So in other words, the starter for the time being is the guy that's going to take all the first-team reps. He's the inherent leader for now, right? The two would be the supporter, prepare. His job would be to be in the room or be on the sideline there to support the starter, but he still takes on all the preparedness of becoming the guy who is going to lead the team one day. You know, and then for the time being, the third guy would be the development player, right? His job is to essentially lead the scout team, right, and prepare the defense. So I think those are all task-related roles that happen within the hierarchy, but they're all temporary to maintain harmony, cooperation, and competition. Does that make sense, Matt?
Yeah, it makes total sense. And it's interesting because as you talk about that, you think about the example you brought of Alex Smith and Patrick Mahomes, and you can see why, as you describe it, that Andy Reid gives so much credit to Alex Smith for how he handled this situation, seeing kind of the writing on the wall where this was probably going to head if Patrick Mahomes stays healthy and performs and works to the level that he was supposed to, that, you know, that he was heading out and that his job, even as the starter, was to be helpful in being a part of preparing Patrick Mahomes for his future. And, you know, and I can see how, you know, in many situations, it would be difficult where whether you feel like you have several years left in the league to be able to play at this at a high level, and they draft someone behind you that they feel like they're really excited about to compete and possibly, you know, be the face of that franchise down the line, or whether you're in a battle, a competition for a job, and and it was a tight competition and one of you has to sit down and be in that second role. I would have to imagine that that's where, you know, especially when you're talking about, you know, even young men, you know, who, you know, may have been through this before, still now with money on the line, with, you know, with fame on the line, with just the high level competition and wanting to be out there on the field, that it really is a test of one's maturity.
It really is. I think self-awareness is a big part of this puzzle. You know, but I think it's so unique, the relationships that you form in that room, because, you know, it's been done really, really well when guys are genuine friends with one another. And it goes well beyond, you know, the cooperation or the best interest of the team or just the competition, but guys, you know, they also hang out together, right? Or they're in each other's weddings, or they were roommates. And I look back on my own journey, and I saw that, you know, at Tarleton State in my college career. My backup at SMU transferred with me to Tarleton State, and we were roommates at SMU. We became roommates at Tarleton State, and he was the starter at one point, and then I overtook him, and I became the starter. He's now a high school coach, and I went on to have a pro career. But those relationships were still intact. You know, and I think it takes a great level of maturity, great level of self-awareness, like I said, but it's not always the case. You know, this is still, and, you know, you don't have to be best friends, and we see it happen all the time in the NFL. Guys aren't necessarily best friends, but they do understand cooperation. They do understand harmony. And at the end of the day, they understand that if you can accomplish those two things, a la a Josh McCown, you can earn a great reputation and career just being a highly cooperative, harmonizing teammate in the room. And there's a lot of value there.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that's so overlooked by fans, because they are thinking with a mindset of who's going to start, who's going to put up yards, who's going to put up points, and who's quote-unquote good because of that definition. When, you know, being a professional is so much more, as you described in that film room, I mean, in that quarterback room, and it's funny because, I mean, as I've talked about a lot on this podcast, I come from a musical background, and I see so many parallels to this, because it's, you know, you work in a band or a big band and you have different parts, and every, you know, there's, you know, maybe there's five trombone players or six saxophone players, and you're all trying out and competing for a certain spot or a certain chair and role in that band. and certain people have, you know, different strengths than others, but oftentimes maybe they split those roles and on different tunes, but they're still competing for jobs together. And I think that you see that kind of friendship there. But it's then the same thing that comes with competition is respect, is that you may get competitive with someone, and it may even get to a point where it can get heated. And I think you see it often in something like boxing, where there's so much trash talk before a fight, and there's a lot of animosity that seems to be there. But when it's over, after you've really competed hard with someone, it's hard not to respect that person at the end of it. And I think that you see that a lot with football kind of behind the scenes there.
That's right. Yeah.
So let's move on. And one of the things that I'd just like to ask you about from your journey is, and maybe how also this applies to quarterbacks that you've worked with, I kind of break down quarterback in a very general sense of that, you know, there's the physical, conceptual, technical, strategic elements, and even the creative elements of performing. And I know that there may be a different answer for each, but I'd love to know where you, and then also quarterbacks that you've worked with, have made the most gains in those areas of play.
Yeah. Okay. So this isn't it's a really good question. This is an evolving question as I look back on my time personally as development or in development as a player, or the way that I've tried to develop other players. And so, you know, I would say that I used to think that I could segment, you know, or really compartmentalize working with quarterbacks. And so what do I mean by that? I used to think that all those things that you just named were really mutually exclusive of one another. So I could segment just working on technique with a player, and then I could segment just being in the classroom and working strategy and concepts with a player, and then I could segment trying to build this creativity as a player. And what I've realized, the more I've educated myself, the more I've learned, is that all these pieces are interconnected, and it's impossible to impact technique and not impact, you know, the mindset, you know, and there's that aspect to it as well, right? And so all these limbs are connected to one another. Nothing's mutually exclusive of the other. And so why that enlightening moment happened, like why that matters, is because now that I understand that it's all interconnected, now I also understand that really outside the context of football, you know, as a private coach who works one-on-one with a player, I now also understand that I'm also limited as a coach. And so what do I mean by that? You know, I'm much more realistic now through education about my impact on a player. And so I'm a lot more mindful now about my approach on what I can really accomplish in a one-on-one setting versus, you know, if I'm a traditional coach working with quarterbacks in the context of team. So what I'm getting at is, in a one-on-one setting, you know, I'm way more mindful now of knowing, okay, really the big four things I can really accomplish and make great gains in working with quarterbacks is confidence, you know, number one. And that happens through the way that I give feedback and the way that I cue a guy. It happens through conversations. And then two, I would say, is fundamentals and technique, because, you know, I can't really get into skill acquisition, motor skill development, outside the context of real football. You know, I'm missing too many things on a field alone with the quarterback to really think that I'm impacting him more than that. And so, you know, the things I can handle there are, you know, basic fundamentals, basic technique, you know, footwork, you know, the physical literacy type stuff of quarterback development, very foundational type things, very general. The third thing I would say is that I can impact kind of the early stages of football IQ. And so I can teach general principles of strategy and conceptualizing things for a quarterback, but ultimately I can't teach true progression because I'm missing a defense. I can't teach true progression within the context of scheme because I'm not teaching him an entire scheme. His coordinator is, you know, and all those things are interconnected. And so the last thing that I would say is really I can bring a sounding board to a quarterback. And if I'm a sounding board for a guy, for him to go have his experience on the field, whether it be practice or performance of games, and come back to me, and we can have this continuity and conversation, then ultimately I can help bring better perspective and 30,000-foot view principles to his, you know, grassroots experience that he's having on a day-in, day-out basis with his coaches, with his team, in the locker room, in the weight room. you know, in his confidence. And so those are probably all the ways that I see that I can make the most gains with a quarterback today that I didn't see then or in the past, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and it's funny because I can relate to that as my journey as someone who's making a living evaluating talent at positions on the internet is that, you know, early on you go into this and you think that, you know, whether a player's success was something defined, whether you got a player right or wrong, when in fact, really all you're doing and all that I'm really trying to do and what I've realized is try to show what I see and project as much of that as I can, knowing that I don't know anything about the player's personality. I don't know anything about their background. I don't know how they work. I don't know how the fit's going to be with interpersonal relationships with their team, what kind of opportunities that they're going to have. And you know, really all I'm trying to describe is ranges of possibilities and give people an idea of that and know that that's a lot less than saying I was right about a player. You know, and it's so in a sense of, you know, I can relate to that from, you know, when you look at both of those things, and I can see also how someone, you know, could someone developing helping develop a quarterback, if they work a ton on technique, they might be technically sound. But does that mean that they're going to apply that strategically well? You know, are they going to be able to do different things creatively if, you know, just because you've emphasized on, and if they've segmented one area, because really it's like you said, putting it all together as much as you can.
Yeah, I think as a coach and evaluator, and I know we'll get to evaluation in just a bit, but you know, as a coach, I think we're looking for confirmation bias. You know, we have a very self-serving opinion of ourselves, and we're very prideful, you know, very egocentric, and so we kind of lack self-awareness sometimes and have blind spots. And I think what we fail to realize is it really takes a village to raise a QB. You know, yeah. We may make gains here, but on the continuum of his career, you know, it's just, it's laughable for, you know, for instance, a private coach to sit there and say, hey, yeah, that's my guy, or I developed him, when you had him, you know, maybe 12 hours and 365 calendar year, you know, and yeah. It's just, I think we need to put ourselves in a better seat, you know, so we can really see things the way that we need to see them when we develop a guy.
Yeah. And I can imagine that the business end of that probably gets in the way of, you know, putting it in the proper focus. So that can be a difficult thing. You know, one of the things that I watch the game, it seems to me, you know, quarterback is so hard to watch and kind of evaluate from a projecting what you think someone could possibly do. It's always known kind of as the white whale of any type of people who are doing any type of evaluation of positions. And you know, one of the things that it just seems to me I'd like to bounce off you is that I've always thought that the NFL, just as a league, has placed too much emphasis on kind of what I call the science of quarterback play. While important, it feels like that, you know, they're looking at things that they can track, you know, what they can measure, because and measure easily, really, more than anything. So you see a lot of things that were focused on, you know, memory, intellectual, you know, kind of logic, intelligence, book smarts type of thing, size, you know, whether their technique was, you know, certain types of technique and arm talent. But at the same time, the people that it seems like that were being celebrated the most and who were oftentimes the most productive were the ones who had the more integrated skills of being able to be intuitive and creative with everything that they do. And oftentimes maybe weren't the most intelligent in terms of book smarts or test-taking skills. But at the same time, you know, they could put it really together on the field because they had different types of intelligence that aren't always measured well by the league. So I just wondered if, you know, what your thoughts are on about, you know, the type of emphasis that's placed that you see in, you know, pre-draft reporting or, you know, in the league in terms of coaching staffs, and seeing how, you know, whether the observations I made make any sense, or whether, you know, you have a different point of view.
Yeah, no, I think they make complete sense. I think there's twofold to this. I think there's evaluation and there's development. And why both are important is because those will ultimately equal production, and then that production is what determines the reputation of that player. Did he reach his potential or did he not? What was he? And you know, without outcomes, we can't even have this conversation, right? So to know what was missing and what was right in the evaluation, what was wrong. And so I agree with you. I think there's way too much, you know, on the tangible aspects of the position, not enough on the intangible. And it makes sense why, right? I mean, it's this common sense type stuff because, you know, the intangible is extremely hard to quantify, right? It's the see, taste, touch, feel is a lot more tactile for the evaluator than the intangible aspect. So, you know, personally, I think that the best way to evaluate a player is objectively. And you alluded to that just a bit earlier. But, you know, the impartiality of being able to evaluate without bias, I think, is an extremely huge part of quarterback evaluation. And so, you know, how this gets misconstrued within the context of professional organizations, you know, the NFL, whether it be the scouts or the coaches, is, you know, self-conservation is a big part of that process of scouting and evaluation at that level. And that's a problem. Why? Because, you know, now wins and losses are directly tied. Job security is directly tied to that pick. And so, you know, look, some of this is principles of accounting, to be honest with you, Matt. And so what do I mean by that? Like, measuring the intangible assets is kind of the holy grail of quarterback evaluation, the same way that it's the holy grail of accounting. And so, you know, a QB's intangible skills are worth so much more to an organization than their tangible assets. We know that. But intangible aspects of a quarterback are really hard to qualify and evaluate, which makes them really a much more powerful source of sustainable competitive advantage for any quarterbacking coach or organization, right? And so I think of, you know, Trubisky and Mahomes, right? This is how the intangible assets are so much harder to qualify and evaluate than what makes that evaluation so much more sustainable and a competitive advantage. So the people that can do this end up winning in the long run, right? It's the same people that chose Pennington, Carmazzi, man, there are six guys, Bolger, right. I think Martin, Spurgeon, Wynn, and Chris Redman before Brady. You know, those people couldn't quantify the intangible assets of the player, and ultimately the people that can do that end up with so much more of a powerful source of sustainable competitive success in the long run. A la the Patriots, right? They're still standing. And so I think what makes it really difficult is, unlike the tangible assets, the intangible aspects of a quarterback are worth different things to different coaches. And so I think of, like, styles and systems for quarterbacks, right? And the draft is counterproductive in this process. Why? Because, you know, I might have a West Coast system where a quarterback that's more mobile, more agile, can throw the ball off the platform, likes to move the pocket, is so much more advantageous to my system. But the number one or two prospect on the list is a 6'5 rocket arm prototype quarterback that's labeled as a can't miss prospect, and I have self-conservation bias, you know, weighing on my shoulders and wins and losses. So I have to go take this guy, but he's not a quote unquote fit, you know? And so that's a problem. And so, you know, my second point here is that the intangible assets, they almost never create value by themselves. Okay. And so I'm going to describe this, like, they need to be combined with other assets. So quarterbacking is a very highly dependent position. And so what do I mean by that? The intangible assets being combined with other assets because they don't stand alone. I think of Tom Brady. Okay, Tom Brady is not a highly tangible aspect type quarterback, right? I mean, he's slow-footed. He's not athletic. I would say he has above-average arm strength. It's pretty good, but it's not Aaron Rodgers. It's not Brett Favre, you know? And so what intangible aspect does he bring? He brings leadership, right? He brings durability, sustainability, obviously cognitive processing. But he doesn't stand alone. He's combined with other assets. Those assets are arguably the greatest coach in the history of football, right? A phenomenal play caller, an organization with strong structural culture, right? and they have a system in process, the Patriot way. That so that combination with Brady's intangible assets make them unbelievable. I think of Pat Mahomes. He has the intangible assets of being a highly creative off-platform thrower, right, with strong arm, and he's athletic enough. But he's combined with the assets of a guy who understands him as a play caller, Andy Reid, who has a past with highly athletic quarterbacks and guys that can throw off platforms like Brett Favre, like Michael Vick, like Donovan McNabb. And he has Tyreek Hill. He has Kelsey. He has Hunt. He has other phenomenal players around him. You know, and so those are two different types of assets, right? One's structural, systematic. The other is players around him, maybe play caller with Mahomes. But ideally, you have both, right? I've got this, the system structure, and I have the assets of players around me. And for that kind of quarterback, I think of a guy like Troy Aikman, right? He was big, prototype, had good feet. He was not highly athletic at by any means, strong enough arm, but he had both. He had Hall of Fame, Gold Jacket players around him, and he had a system of play callers and structure around him in an organization, continuity that brought him long-term success as well, you know? And so what happens, this is a really important question, what's the other end of the spectrum? What happens when you had the intangible aspects of a highly dynamic quarterback without the combined assets of all those other things? Well, you end up with an Aaron Rodgers. You end up with a LeBron James. You end up with a Dan Marino. What do I mean by that? Unbelievably gifted, once-in-a-generation type players who play, Aaron Rodgers' case, 13 years and only have one Super Bowl, right? You have LeBron James, who spent 11 years in Cleveland, right, and he only had one championship in that time. Why? These guys lacked the organizational structure, and, you know, to an extent, they lacked the supporting cast around them.
Yeah. I think listening, I mean, that was terrific. And listening to you talk about it, when you talk about intangible assets, I think from an evaluator standpoint of, you know, I mean, one of the things that I've constantly been working on over the years when I evaluate quarterbacks is how to break down decision making into questions and weights for those answers. That, and I have the challenge of that I don't have a coaching staff I'm working with that tells me this is the scheme we're looking at that we want to use the player in, and this is what we value higher or lower than others. And, you know, if I had, you know, a lot of the way that I evaluate and the process I use is actually flexible to adjusting for that. It wants to adjust for those types of things, but I have to look from a much more generic standpoint. So I'm always trying to break down decision-making more because I look at it, and as you talk about those intangible assets, to me, all I could think of was the word glue. You know, it's the glue that holds all the other things together. So it needs those things to actually create something of substance that's going to be useful. But alone, it's just glue, you know? So you need to have the players, you need to have the scheme, you also need to have the coaching, you need to have certain level of technical facility and processing skill. But it's kind of, that, I think that's why I always think of it as, think of certain skills together that show that type of intangible ability as integrated technique. And what I realize is that it's not so much integrated as much as it's the glue that bonds these things together to create good play.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's just fascinating to listen to that, because like a guy like Mahomes would be a good example of, you watch him, you know, up until the Patriots game, and you would see that, you know, a lot of people described him as reckless. And I've always kind of argued that, yeah, maybe early in his career as a collegiate player, he was reckless. I always kind of always argued that he was more daring. He evolved into becoming a more daring player who would make throws that maybe, you know, very few people would. But when you look at the decision in the down and distance context, in the context of where the coverage was, even if it was an off platform across the field, you know, balletic throw, you'd look and go, well, who else would he have hit if he doesn't hit this receiver? And you're thinking the coverage is nowhere near there. He threw it behind the man so that if the receiver can't catch it, no one would. And when you look at situations like that compared to, say, someone like, who I think arguably still developing in that area, like Trubisky, who I think has been more apt in inside the that either inside his own 20 or inside the red zone to make throws that I would describe more often as reckless, and where, you know, in situations where the defense said, we're going to take away, you know, the first read or the hopeful design of this play and make you do some things off script and create within what's going on in that defense. And you see one player or some players do a good job of understanding and seeing and processing what's there and making a wise decision, even if it's a daring one, where others may make the daring decision and it not be a wise one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's you can't oversimplify. You know, that's the problem with quarterback evaluation is 1 + 1 isn't always equal 2, you know, and that's the hard part. I mean, a daring throw over the middle that ends up incomplete that you would consider unwise still shows up on the stat sheet as an incompletion and hurts the completion percentage in the long run. And it would be no different than Aaron Rodgers the other day purposefully taking the snap and throwing the incompletion directly out of bounds to situationally handle the end of the game so Mason Crosby can hit a field goal with time expiring, you know. And both would be incompletions, whether it be by the quarterback that threw over the middle late and the guy that took the snap on purpose and threw it out of bounds. They show up on the stat the exact same way, but the decisions weigh completely differently within the context of IQ.
Yeah. You know? And the way that
– you know, and it,
go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say this about evaluation is I always think it's directly – tied to development in the sense that, you know, evaluation is just the first half of the process.
Yeah.
Why I become dismayed with the NFL process is that I think that talent development of that player evaluation is a very self-fulfilling process. And so what do I mean by that? You know, when a coach or a bunch of evaluators look at, you know, name any quarterback, we've talked a lot about Pat Mahomes. So when they look at a Pat Mahomes and they deem him to be worth a lot of value, all his tangible and intangible assets they love, well, they're going to be much more likely to give him time to develop, right, and make mistakes. They're going to be very forgiving, allow him to fail forward, right, and they're going to justify that. Conversely, the opposite would be true for a player that came in with a poor evaluation, maybe had all the same tangible or intangible assets, but because of his evaluation – and the impartiality that was shown in that evaluation, he's not given the same opportunity to develop and see what happens. And so any mistake that he makes becomes almost terminal, right? And inconclusive. You're not willing to give him grace or give him more opportunity to allow himself to make mistakes and work through the same that you would the other player. And to me, that's a huge issue in player development. And I personally am one to think there's probably other Bradys out there in the world who have come through the NFL and never had the opportunity to reach their potential because of these self-fulfilling prophecies of quarterback development.
You know, I just want to caution my audience and just state right off the bat that I did not pay Rich to explain all of this as confirmation to my buddy Ryan Riddle's article a long time ago when he left the NFL. Of the hidden advantage of being a high round draft pick and how draft capital is exactly like that. I often reference what you just said and what Ryan stated as a former defensive end and outside linebacker in the league. Often because it's that idea. It's that bias, you know, you're a first round pick, the team's invested money in you and if you're in practice, you're going to get more reps, you know, you're going to get more chances to make mistakes. Whereas if you're an undrafted guy, you know, you can make fewer mistakes, have fewer reps, but that one mistake you make, the coaches may look at each other and go, see, I told you that guy can't play, where they look at the other guy and he's made three times as many of the same mistakes and maybe even worse and go, we just need to give him more time. And
that's right.
And so it's fascinating how that is. So I just kind of wanted to underscore that for people that this is, you know, this is the type of thing that multiple people who have worked with NFL players or have been in the NFL, they experience that. And I think that's the thing that's hard with developing an evaluation process as well, is that because you said everyone's, you know, there's a self-serving kind of survivalist aspect to you know, the game of keeping a job, that you can't invest in the you can't kind of put the seeds in the ground to really build an evaluation process that's going to grow with what you do, that's going to incorporate, ask the right questions for what you want to try and do, and stick with things long term, because you don't know if the coach is going to be there long enough. You don't know who's going to be there in terms of your players. You don't know, and that infrastructure often leaves with it. So just as your infrastructure is figuring things out, because you figure things out by making mistakes. By the time you finish making your mistakes, you've already basically have been, you've basically been gotten rid of, and house has been cleaned, and now they're going with something completely different. And I think that that's the most dismaying thing for me with the NFL is growing up and watching it. You know, while I want players to get paid and I want them to be able to have the benefits that they deserve for the hard work that they do, you know, I think the dismaying thing is a fan, even watching from a fan's perspective, is one thing that free agency has done, at least in the vein that free agency has been structured, is that you don't see teams really building and sticking with players and sticking with coaches. Because you wonder if Terry Bradshaw or John Elway would have been stuck with as long as they were in their careers, you know, if they were in the era that we are now. I mean, I have to imagine that, you know, with their level of talent relative to what they were doing, that you would think that's the case, especially as early round guys. But you don't know, when you think about how football has changed as a business. So it's just interesting to me in that way. You know, a couple more questions for you, and then we'll just continue with the evaluation part. I've been doing this for about 15 years now, and just starting to at least figure out some basic things. And what's, you know, one of the, I know that as far as having an eye to see, getting better at learning how to define certain things so that I'm trying to see things in a more holistic way, in an integrated way, and I'm not just stuck on athletic ability or completely bound to technique, and kind of understanding how things work enough together to be able to at least to describe some range of outcomes in a way that people can kind of see and understand that I'm incorporating different scheme fits and accounting for enough things that people can look at that and they watch a player on the field and they say, I see what that person wrote about that player. That makes sense. I can see why they think that player could be better here, or why this may be difficult for them if they don't learn more here. And to me, the whole goal is to describe the player and his range of possibilities that are within a logical way accurately as possible. But, you know, it doesn't make one of the things, spending that time doing that, I'm still learning a lot about X and O's. You know, there's times that I'll be going through a play on Twitter and I don't recognize C3 right away, cover 3 right away. And I'll miss it. And somebody will point out, that wasn't cover 1, that was cover 3. And I go, oh yeah, I just realized what I missed here with, with the cues of the defensive, with the defensive back, with this particular shade or how they work that out. And I figure that there are a lot of, I started thinking about that because I'd first feel bad. I go, God, how did I miss that? Or how did I miss that? And then I think, well, Brett Favre didn't know what nickel was until, a couple years into the league. And I have to think that there are a lot of young quarterbacks in the pros who might be great at certain things, but then they have weaknesses in others. And I've had other people who are, make their living on, writing about the game from an analysis standpoint, of X's and O's and go to coaching clinics and know everything about the history of, the Veer or, and they'll say to me, but the evaluation to me is a completely different animal. Like it's a different skill. So that made me think about quarterbacking and wondered, as someone who spent 15 years of really working methodically at trying to figure out how to begin to evaluate talent, I still have a lot more work to do and improve upon with my X and O's game and my recognition game, because my goal is I'd love to be able to, it's one of those hopefully attainable, but may never be, that I'd love to be able to have a pro sit and have a whiteboard conversation with a pro coach and they look at me and go, did you play quarterback? And say, no, I never played at all. So I'd like to know, what your thoughts are. And when you see you've worked with a lot of quarterbacks about certain areas of strengths and weaknesses that they have, especially with X and O's, what are the best ways that you found to help them improve upon, you know, seeing the game schematically, strategically, and being able to develop that area?
Yeah, so, again, I think the more I learn, you know, the more I have a better perspective of what I'm really capable of doing with a player, you know, in a one-on-one context. And so I think it depends on the age, obviously, but also it kind of doesn't. And so what do I mean by that? Well, if you understand what is football IQ, you know, I'm a big fan of kind of defining the terms and then understanding, okay, what's the goal, and then how do you accomplish that goal with any player? And so, you know, football IQ lives on a continuum of maturity from least mature to most mature, you know, in your career. And football IQ is not the same as fluid IQ. I never even thought about fluid IQ until I just started learning more. And then I thought, okay, this makes more sense. Why is it that I started looking up Wonderlic scores and all, you know, Dan Marino's at like a 15 or 16, Vince Young's at a 6 or 7. And, you know, all these other elite level players are testing so low in IQ, yet they're phenomenal Pro Bowl type players, or they win Rookie of the Year. They're Hall of Famers. And I guess what I came to was, you know, there's more than meets the eye in this kind of evaluation of IQ. And so football IQ, as I understand it, is, to me, it's birthed in the classroom, but it's not just the classroom. Okay. And so the classroom is a very educational, foundational type room. It's got a whiteboard, a chalkboard, right? It's transparencies, it's books, it's 1 + 1 = 2, it's math. But that alone that doesn't necessarily translate to the field for performance, right? That would be like saying that golfing is hitting driving range balls. That's not true. Going to the driving range is hitting on the driving range. Playing golf is playing golf. Two different things. And so if it's birthed in the classroom, then it's raised in practice, right? Because I'm able to transfer, you know, aspects of my knowledge and what I've learned, but now there's moving parts, right? But I don't have the extrinsic pressures of performance. I'm not going to get hit. There's no wins or losses. But I need to be able to get hit. I need the wins and losses, extrinsic factors, to impact my performance so that I can learn more about football IQ. And then that's why, you know, football IQ is ultimately matured in games, because without the games, then I lack the extrinsic pressures that take me to throwing the ball away before I get sacked in a 2-minute situation, or allow me to take the sack in a 4-minute situation. That's a good play. I guess my point is that like development also lives on a continuum. It's trifold. It's classroom practice and games. It's not one or the other. It has nothing to do with how smart you are in books or grades, GPA. And, you know, it's also about, you know, just frankly, it's about neuroplasticity, and it's about cognition. And, you know, from youth to about, you know, college age, you know, we're the most impressionable in our ability to be, to have neuroplasticity, right? To be able to contort our minds and brains and take on all kinds of dynamic information and have rapid retention and recall, right? I mean, this is why they say kids can learn so many different languages. It's easier early than it is late. And if you think about it in your professional development as a player and a quarterback, you know, although you're more neuroplasticity, you have more of that early in your career in learning the game and learning strategy and learning concepts and learning football. By the time I get to college and on into my pro career, if I play into my mid, late 20s, early 30s, 40s, if you're Brady, it becomes harder for me to learn systems and to expand my mind and to have that rapid retention and recall. Now you say, well, Brady's playing at a really high level late. So is Breeze. Rodgers is dominant, right? Roethlisberger. Well, these guys, Manning, for instance, Favre did it late into his career. But all of those guys, what did they have? They didn't have to really have neuroplasticity of their own system because they played in the same system time and time again.
Yeah.
They never had to leave the system. So they had rapid retention and recall that only got finer and got more perfected and never had to bend itself or be completely erased and then relearned. And when it did happen, Matt, with Brett Favre,
yes,
he was not good with the Jets.
No,
he became good again when he got to Minnesota, and he had Darrell Bevell again, the same coach, the same system that he had when he was in Green Bay. He was able to go right back to what he had always known. And so, when you think of cognitive processing, football IQ, fluid IQ, this is about anatomical and functional structure in somebody's brain. It's no different than it is for an athlete, non-athlete. There's a disparity there in these things, but there's also disparity in a novice athlete and a professional athlete in the cognitive processing. And so that's about processing speed and attention. It's about processing complex human movement. It's about multitasking in crowds. And so this is all a part of fluid IQ and something that's way more important than just football IQ.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And it is, and it, because football is performance. It's a performance craft, if you ask me. And it's a situation where you've got, like you said, you've got to get that playing time. And it reminds me of, I mean, I was listening to a podcast by this guy, Cal Fussman, who is a popular interviewer. And he interviewed this Grammy Award winning saxophonist by the name of David Sanborn, who's probably like the sound of the alto saxophone. It's kind of like saying that Aaron Rodgers is the face of quarterbacking in the NFL. You know, he's the multi-Grammy winner who began his life with polio, could barely raise one of his arms over his head, was in an iron lung, was paralyzed at a young age, and took up the instrument because he heard Ray Charles Band at the end of a basketball game, of an NBA game, like back in the, I guess it was in the 50s or 60s with the Minnesota Lakers and I don't remember the St. Louis Hawks. So he's, he developed, but it was one of those things that he developed so much, not just so much because of the technical end. For him, the technical end was so bad that he was in grade school and his band director in grade school told his parents that they needed to kick him out of the band because he was too slow and he was slowing down the rest of the band because he couldn't read music well. And that's very much an X's and O's type of thing. But this is a guy who ended up going to, kept playing and he focused a lot on performance, and a lot of his time was playing with records, even if he wasn't playing anything right. He was just getting used to feeling what it's like to interact with a number of different players. And then he went and actually went on stage and played with a number of different people on stage, to the fact that like someone like Little Milton came to town and the piano player was a couple years older than them and was like, you want to play with us on stage? And he's like, wasn't that much of a player, but ended up, just playing a bit part, but getting used to, again, being in that moment and playing with different people and using what he did know, and slowly got better at the theoretical aspects of the game. But he was really strong at the performance aspects of it. And as a result of it, he ended up in a situation where he did get to school, but he wasn't even a scholarship guy at a college where he was with this renowned saxophone player who heard him practice and heard him try out. And he sat there for 30 seconds and looked at me and goes, "How did you even get here?" And, this is a guy who went on to play with the Rolling Stones, with Stevie Wonder, with, James Taylor, who had his own albums, who hosted a music show in the late 80s on NBC with Lorne Michaels as the producer, getting like the Red Hot Chili Peppers together with people like, blues musicians and having them perform together, or Bootsy Collins with a huge band. I mean, like he's like the, he is the studio musician, of studio musicians at his instrument. And like any sound that if you watch any cheesy 80s movie that has a alto saxophone playing on it, that's probably someone, either him playing or someone copying his sound. So it's just a fascinating thing in terms of how you look at, you look at that type of a situation. So having that performance is so important, because as you continue to work on developing the technical, if you don't have that feel and that comfort level and that ability to make decisions and interact with people in a good way up on that stage, then I think all those lessons, you can be really great in a classroom, but you have to, all those elements have to come together. And I think I can see why, from an X's and O's standpoint, you can be a whiz on a whiteboard, but if you get on the stage on the lights, under the lights, with everything moving around and the intensity of a game, that, that part of it has to really be there too. And that's such a harder thing to like systematically develop.
That's right. Yeah, and if you, you know, if you think of all this you're talking about, I mean, if you just think of the NFL Combine, I mean, it's like the opposite of everything we're talking about. It's like the seductive evaluation tool just to screw everybody up. Like,
yes.
I don't see how anybody can get better in their evaluation at the Combine. It's missing everything, right? And it's misleading in so many ways. It doesn't matter from shorts to T-shirts to the Wonderlic to lacking practice context. You forget the game film. It's like you're evaluating with your eyes in person. So now I'm making decisions based on, you know, you don't even realize you're doing these subconscious things, right? Oh, I think he's dumb because his eyes are close together. You know, you don't even realize you make those kinds of decisions, but because of the way he looks, I think he's not as smart. Or I saw he was sagging his pants. That means he was unprofessional. Or he used the word conversate versus, you know, conversational. You know, I don't think he's intellectual. It's just like, I don't understand the NFL Combine.
Yeah, me neither. I've never been. I don't really have plans to go. And to me, it's like, yes, I understand that metrics, you can use certain metrics to at least explore ranges of athletic ability and athletic thresholds, but you still have to be very careful to understand that those are raw tools and that, you know, somebody who runs a 4.29 40 doesn't mean that they play faster than the guy who runs a 4.7 40. The guy with a 4.7 40 with good technique, precise footwork and understanding of how coverage works is going to get open far more often than the 4.2 guy who can't get off the jam, who can't read the coverage and doesn't find the right soft spot in the field or can't make a break to get separation against tight coverage when it's man. So it's like all those things come together and I look at, you know, for me, it's like I look at those baseline metrics as kind of archetypes or like baselines for certain archetypes of players in terms of like different styles and try and piece those things together on a certain level. But it, for me, it's more like, does he have enough acceleration to ride the ride in the NFL? And my baselines are a lot lower than I see in the media, you know, because when I look at Arian Foster running a 4.71 and I see what he did on a football field, I know that, you know, quick short area quickness, stop start quickness, change of direction quickness, different types of explosion are all important things, and you can see that as well. But on top of that, none of that matters if he doesn't make the correct decisions, understanding what his blocking schemes are about. You know, understanding how to read those and set those up. Does he have good pad level? Does he know how to vary his footwork? Does he have, you know, I mean, there's so many factors in that. And I think that all those things, and, you know, as you discussed, are just approximations of all they are is segmented areas that are overly simplified, and you've got to be really, really, really careful with how you look at that. So,
yes, sir.
Yeah. So listen, before we go, I would love to know if, you know, just based on what you've watched, who you've watched in the college and NFL game this year, or at least recently, you know, who's caught your eye for any reason?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a few guys have caught my eye. And not necessarily for the best reason. So I would say like Jared Stidham at Auburn has caught my eye. And I've known of him for a while now and I've watched him. But particularly this year, because, you know, as I understand it, it seems like, he's about ready to come out and head on to the NFL. It seems, even though he's got another year of eligibility. And, I'm enamored with what seems like a lack of development, or, you know, just underachievement. And that's not anything on his offensive coordinator, quarterback, coach, or anything like that. I mean, to be quite honest with you, I feel like, you know, I just see a player of his caliber physically, you know, and how talented he is with just natural giftedness, right? The ability to throw the football. I mean, his motion is gorgeous, right? And I just see a guy that is lacking fit kind of in a system. Something's missing there, and I don't know why, but I look at his potential to date, and I just see kind of underachievement. And I think that's interesting. I don't know how that plays out in the NFL or anything like that, you know, and like I said, it's not an indictment on Auburn. I just personally believe that there's a misdiagnosis and lack of self-awareness in his process when he transferred from Baylor and where he could and should have gone. And I thought he may have been a better fit in a different type of system than where he went to. And then conversely, I look at somebody like Dwayne Haskins. I mean, Dwayne is somebody that I saw, had the privilege of seeing on one weekend back in Baltimore in his sophomore year of high school. And I'm not going to say that I knew he would become a Heisman candidate, but I would tell you that, and I told him this, is he reminded me of the 25 NFL quarterbacks I was around, not just physically, but I'm talking more so in his countenance and his presence and the way that he stood next to me in the conversations that we had. I was just blown away with his perspective, his self-awareness. I felt like he was on a mission, a plan. He saw himself for what he was and where he wanted to be, and he had a great tension between both of those things. He's very mature, and it's not surprising to see him do what he's doing right now. Here's a dark horse and somebody that you would never expect that I would bring up, who's caught my two games in, is Brock Purdy at Iowa State, and he's a true freshman, and nobody cares about him, and I get that. And he's 6 foot or 6'1", 200 pounds. But when I watched him play last weekend, and I don't want to get caught up in what they did, right? They had a big win against a top 10 team and all these kinds of things, but this is a three-star kid who gained a lot of momentum late in his process. He had a phenomenal, tremendous career in high school. So he's got a ton of playing experience. He had a lot of success. He had a ton of production. I think he had like 5,000 yards of total offense as a senior in high school, over 70 touchdowns or close to. And I'm familiar with who Iowa State already has there, who got there in the spring last year. They had this kid named Real Mitchell, who I know is a far more dynamic, athletic, elite-level type kid physically. And so for a kid like Brock to walk into that situation as a backup quarterback, as a guy in his own class who got there late to his competition, Real Mitchell, who's a less dynamic athlete, and then watch him play and have the success that he's had the last week and a half to 2 weeks, this is a kid that I cannot wait to watch again or more. When I see his confidence, his command, the types of throws he's capable of making. He can layer every ball. He puts the ball vertically as well as horizontally. He's athletic enough to hold the defense accountable, whether it be in man press or two-man. He could take advantage. And so he's somebody who's caught my eye, and I think he may just be in the right place at the right time with Matt Campbell. I mean, Matt Campbell, I think, is a highly talented coach. So we'll see how his career blossoms. It's extremely early. Nobody would ever think that I would name a kid like that, but he's somebody who's caught my eye.
That's fantastic. I love hearing that. So listen, this was just such a great conversation. It's always a pleasure to have you on the RSP cast, and you can find Rich Bartel at Coach Rich Bartel, RICHBARTEL on Twitter. And he does some fantastic commentary there, talking about quarterback development, that I would encourage any of you just to check out his timeline. You will find it very educational and insightful. Thank you again, Rich, for being on today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Matt. We'll talk soon, man.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of the RSP Cast. You can check out more RSP Casts on iTunes, on Twitter, on Google Play, as well as Blueberry and Stitcher. It's Matt Waldman's RSP Cast. That's where you can find it. You can also check out my work on YouTube at Matt Waldman's RSP Film Room. You can also check out my work at my site, www.mattwaldmanrsp.com, where you can see writers like David Ogono, the former defensive back for West Virginia, Mark Schofield, a former quarterback at Wesleyan. We've got a new addition in Jackson Block, who's a 19-year-old young man who was the top-rated linebacker in high school, outside linebacker in high school at the state of Colorado, his junior year. And he's made the transition from actually playing football to wanting to scout it. So I can't wait for you to see some of the work that he's going to be putting out. His first thing's going to be on Nick Bosa. And of course, I'm getting ready for the rookie scouting portfolio, the 2019 version. I have over 100 players scouted already, and looking forward to doing a lot more in terms of reports there, and I'll be sharing those things with you as we go. You can check out more about the Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication, available every April 1 as the pre-draft, and then 1 week after the NFL draft is the post-draft publication. So you can check those things out at mattwaldmanrsp.com. Thanks again for listening. Enjoy your week.